call a meeting to order. It's a meeting of the House Commerce Committee. This is the 13th February 1979. A quorum is present. I'm Fred Brown. I'm the chairman. Present are Representative Alvin Osterbach, Representative Richard Randolph, Representative Rick Halford, and Representative Munson, Vice Munson. Representative Bettisworth and Malone are excused from the call of the House. I think one or the other of them may, or both of them may be with us this afternoon, but they're getting back to Juneau from wherever their trips have taken them. This is the time set for a hearing on the kind of an open and general nature with regard to the public policy considerations involved in the purchase of RCA Alaska Communications by Pacific Power and Light of Portland. And I wonder if Glenn and Bob, could you come and sit at this table here with me, if that's all right? Legislative consultant Professor Stanley and Professor Merritt are going to join us. As some of the people here may know, in previous years, the House has had a special committee on telecommunications for the last, really, 4 years, and subcommittees of the Council. I have chaired those committees. This year, the Speaker of the House noted and had spread in the journal a letter indicating that it was his intent not to have a special committee and asking this committee to take over those areas of concern during the legislative sessions and ask the legislative consultants in telecommunications to work with us in that regard. On my left, Professor Glenn M. and Pacific Power and Light. Of course, we do not say yes or no with regard to the purchase, I suppose. It is a matter presently before the Alaska Public Utilities Commission and the Federal Communications Commission. So with and also there has been a hearing already held before the Senate Finance Committee that we have a rather lengthy transcript of that hearing, which my office had to prepare to Karen about a week to do it because for some reason the massive staff of the Senate Finance Committee was too busy. At any rate, we don't have a whole bunch of those right now, but in 20 minutes or so we should have copies for the members of the committee and a couple of extra, as long as you don't give them to members of the Senate Finance Committee. With that, I'd like to call on Mr. Ben Agee, who is the president of RCA Alaska, to acquaint us with the nature of the purchase. And also, I presume or assume that members may end up asking questions about company policies that affect Alaskans beyond the scope of just this sale itself. Mr. Agee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ben Agee. I'm president of RCA Alaska. I had that position for 3 years as of this month. As I look back over those 3 years, I can see a lot of growth in the state in terms of communications. I'm part of a 7-8 year trend that the Alascom companies had since it picked up the property from the military. I've seen it grow in my day to where now we'll switch over 33, 34 million calls this year. We are really have a rather a good system. Basically, in the urban areas, we can compare our service to anybody in the lower 48. In the last 3 years, I've seen us put our first Bush station installation in. And since that time, RCA Alascom, along with the state, has put in additional 100 Bush earth stations for lifeline service in the bush. The service in the bush has not been what we would like in terms of service. By the same token, it's a far cry from what it was 3 years ago. Today we're still having problems, environmental type problems, some problems with some of the equipment, some various other things, but it's getting better. But still, it remains to be seen how much further we want to go there and what we want to do. Over the 3 years, have seen us resolve a lot of problems, a lot of differences down here, worked with the state, so on and so forth. But I've noted the need, frankly, when I talk to my owners, I've noted a need to talk to somebody that's familiar with the utility business. It's a little difficult to talk a regulated industry to a firm that's primarily concerned with television sales, that sort of thing. I think this opportunity we have now, this sale to Pacific Power and Light, really is going to benefit my company, Alascom, and is certainly going to benefit the state of Alaska. I say that for two or three reasons. First, they are a utility business. They're in the regulated business. They understand regulation. They have a proven track record in that field. They understand what we talk about when we deal with the FCC and the PUC and the world of regulation. That has to be a plus. I think secondly, and extremely important to Alaska, as we evolve and fix the problems that confront this state, is we'll now be identified with an organization that's headquartered in Portland. So we're part of the Northwest. They're part of the Northwest. When we talk D2 to them, they sit up and listen. When I'm out east and talking to people out there about what we need to do in Alaska, it's going to be nice to be able to talk to the people from Washington and Oregon as well as our own Alaska delegation. I think that identity with the Northwest is going to be a definite plus. I think third and most important, in a time right now when things aren't really all the greatest in Alaska, and where most of us seem to recognize that we need to have more jobs and an expanded economy, I think it's great when you have a company that wants to come into the state of Alaska and invest $300 million. I think if you stop and think for a moment about that, they have no vested interest in the state. There's no reason they have to come to the state. And for Pacific Power and Light to say we want to be part of Alaska, part of its growth, we want to provide good communications, and we want to be part of the team, we want to come in, I think that's extremely important, as opposed to maybe somebody that might want out. So as president of RC Alascom, and hopefully as president of the new company, Alascom, I have to tell the committee and the chair that I'm extremely pleased with this, the way this is moving. And I certainly hope that this group looks favorably upon the action. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be welcome any questions. Incidentally, Mr. Gleason from Pacific Power is present, and will be a witness a little bit later on to talk about Pacific Power, tell you firsthand about that company. We have a few other people with us today if we need to talk at any length on anything like service finance.
Introduce the people from RC Alaska who are here in the room so that members of the committee will be able to know who we might be able to pick on.
Mr. Robinson right over here is our Executive Vice President. Chuck Kleinjob is Operations. And Chuck, you might want to stand. Tom Jensen back here is our Public Affairs Department. Mike Holmstrom is our Finance Vice President. And I did mention Mr. Gleason right in back of me, Al Gleason, the president of Telephone Utilities and with Pacific Power. I think each of these people...
You have another one on your left and behind you that used to be with the state. Mr. Shaganaw is here.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. George. George Shaganaw, who joined us just about 2 weeks ago as director of planning for our company. A thing we've been needing for some time.
Thank you. Could you tell us, this may be an unusual start, but could you tell us something about your background? Before you were with RC Alaska Communications, what kinds of companies were you with before?
I started out in the telephone business when I was about 14. My father bought and sold exchanges. I spent most of my younger years splicing cable in construction, back in those days, all open wire. Worked a switchboard in Marengo, Iowa, two-position board for quite some time. Then went on to the military, on into the University of Iowa. Graduated there in 1950, and that year I went with the Bell System. Over the next 26 years in the Bell System, I worked in Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota. I had positions in what they call the commercial department, which is the business part of it, the collection, billing, that sort of thing. Then worked in the traffic department, which was basically the central office switching and the operators, long-distance operators, that thing. Hi, Clem.
President, join us if you would. I'm joined by the President of the Senate, Senator Tillion.
I was just describing my background, Senator. Went through commercial department, traffic department, worked in the marketing department where we sold primarily to the government. Spent some time in public relations. Just about every department that existed in the Bell System I worked in at one time or another. I ended up...
Which Bell companies were you working
Northwestern
for?
Bell.
Northwestern
Bell. That comprises the two Dakotas, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Iowa. Mm-hmm. The last 5 or 6 years with Bell, I was in Minnesota as division manager in the Northern Division and then as general manager for the state of Minnesota. That position encompassed similar things to what Mr. Robinson has up in this state. So basically in the small exchange business when I was a younger person and then on into the Bell System. Been here 3 years now.
Well, the reason I asked the question, I'd like you to... that. I suppose established your qualifications. I'd like you to go in a little more detail about a statement you made about in dealing with the upper management of the RCA Corporation and the other RCA corporations. You said you had noted the need to deal with someone who was more familiar, who had been in the utility business. What did you mean by that, and what is the difference, say, between a regulated utility and its management outlook and an RCA Victor, or Hertz Rent-A-Car, or different, or one of the other RCA subsidiaries like that?
I think the biggest thing is the need to work in a regulated environment and to work with regulators. That today, if you want to, I assume, raise the price of your television 50 cents, you raise it 50 cents. And if the market will buy your product, fine. In the telephone business, as you know, when we want to raise rates, we have to file with a commission of some sort, either the FCC or the PUC. Generally speaking, that takes some time to get that through the commission. It's a rather involved process. The people that I worked had a difficult time understanding why did it take so long to act in the face of, let's say, dropping revenues or what have you. Just a difference in attitude.
Are there any other regulated common carrier companies within the RCA corporate structure besides RCA Alaska?
They have a, in communication, they have two things. They have a satellite company that the FCC is involved with, and then they have a foreign operation called Globecom in the international business.
Mm-hmm.
There is no domestic operation similar to ours.
And neither of those are long lines carrier or telephone company per se, are they?
You're correct, Mr. Chairman.
And what portion of their business are represented by those two companies plus yours?
I don't know.
Well, is it 20, at your estimate, 25%?
I just wouldn't know.
Well, I'm sure that as far as any measure of the company, it's less than that. We have here, what I'm passing out to the consultants, the members of the committee, and to the President of the Senate are transcripts of the Senate Finance Committee hearing. I apologize in that they have not really been put in final form, and that my secretary is not as familiar with the voices of the senators as I am, so we have a lot of unknowns here that if you're familiar with the proceedings of the Senate Finance Committee, you know, the unknown as Senator Sackett or somebody like that, but she has the names of all of the non-senatorial witnesses, and she did an excellent job in preparing the transcript itself, which is quite a tedious task, and I'm sure that perhaps between now and particularly this afternoon's meeting, the members may want to look at the questions that arose in the Senate hearing on some of these same subjects, and it may cause them to ask some further questions or go into further considerations along the same lines. You were talking about the lifeline service at the 100 Earth stations. On a social engagement about 2 weeks ago, I asked you some questions. I don't know if you have that information yet or not, but as you'll remember, in 1975, Mr. Heller was president of RC Alaska, and the state of Alaska appropriated $5 million at the behest of quite a few of us for the purchase of small earth stations to be placed in Alaska's very smallest communities to facilitate communications. At that time, it was at least my understanding of legislative intent, the major concern was to start with the first communications building block, which would have been medical emergency communications, that would become part of your service and would provide just that. At a later time, telephone service, the next black box to be added, what your industry calls MTS, would be added, and then eventually television. Well, as things went, the RCA, Alaska Communications people, decided that they would put MTS into all of the earth stations that were actually being installed. But some of them never did get, apparently, the emergency medical communications that would have been operated by the Public Health Service for some reasons I don't quite understand or I don't have full information about. So that we have the somewhat ridiculous position now that there are some villages that even have television under the TV demonstration project that still do not have the emergency, if you like, party line push to talk, basic crude medical emergency communications. I mentioned some of these problems to you, and you said you were going to get some more information to get back to the committee. Do you have any of that information this time?
I don't have any specifics as far as who uses the telephone in those various locations. We put the phone in along with the, again, the joint state RCA effort to work with the AFN. The locations were identified. We made the installations, and the installation generally was two-channel deal, one for MTS and one for other use. There have been in the past, and I can't be specific about this, some agencies that have chose not to use facilities, for what reasons I can't say. We have put the service into the villages, and how they want to use them is really up to them. I don't think it's up to us to say that it ought to be for this purpose or that purpose. But to answer your specific question, Mr. Chairman, I do not have that information.
I'm sure the committee would like to have that information. And
what now, specifically, you want to know what social agencies are using service out there?
Well, I want to know what happened to the original plan, which was supposedly that every village was going to have this emergency medical communication, but it would not necessarily be something that would be wired in or circuited through in the same manner as the MTS service, and that every one of them would have it. My understanding is that it would have been operated by the United States Public Health Service under a program then in existence. Now it's my understanding that something on the order of maybe slightly more than 50% of the villages have that communications capability and the others do not. And if there's a medical emergency, they have to take their chances with getting an operator through the MTS system, and some of them have not been very fortunate in trying to actually make an outgoing telephone call from some of the villages.
Yeah, if we have the service into the village, let's say one of 100, there's no reason why they can't have it if they want it.
Well, some of the information that I heard in about fourth or fifth hand was that some of the problems related to the effect that the intrastate rate increases that have gone through on a temporary basis, and you have your permanent case now pending before the APUC, had affected federal funding for some of the public health service programs. But I have not talked to anybody from the public health service. And this is third and fourth hand information.
Yeah, well, why don't we then try to provide you with the information?
I would like to have that if we could.
Okay.
Can you explain to us, if you know, why the state of Alaska has 20 earth stations in Northern California that are stored in a warehouse there that have not yet been installed anywhere in Alaska, if you know?
I can talk a little bit on that subject. There's been a question. As you know, the Bush ownership is a joint venture between the state and Alascom. And in the order, it says you, as a company, will proceed at your own risk, which simply says if you invest $10-20 million in there and it doesn't work out, your share owners, your stockholders, are out that money. It was our opinion that the agreement was for 100 stations. There became a difference of opinion 6-7 months ago. Some people said that should be an additional 20. We said it's now time to resolve the earth station ownership question to find out whether we're going to own it or the state's going to own it so we can proceed in a normal business manner. And we said there's no reason to go beyond the 100 until this issue is resolved. And at that stage, it sort of bogged down, and since then, it's still awaiting resolution. I'm of the opinion that we ought to decide who's going to own those stations so we can move into it the way we should as a normal business venture, and then move it. You know, the 20, we did offer to buy those 20 from the state, incidentally, and would use them. But we see no reason to continue this thing. We think everything has been answered that needs to be answered. The FCC ought to be in a position to resolve the issue. The state, for that matter, ought to be in a position to resolve the issue.
So it's RCA Alaska's position that they have to win on their position on the ownership of the air stations in the FCC proceeding before they would provide service to those 20 communities. Alternatively, they would insist on owning the earth stations in those 20 communities by buying them from the state. Otherwise, those 20 communities don't get the service. Is that correct?
I don't think so.
Sounds like what you just said,
sir.
No,
I don't think so. I think you're reading a lot into what I said. As far as those 20 exchanges, do you realize what exchanges they are and what service they have today?
They are very small communities.
And do you know what service they have today?
Some of them have very unreliable service, which is almost like a party line service by VHF radio. I'm familiar with that. Some of them have other kinds of marginal service that works, some of them very often doesn't work more than 50%.
In some cases, it may be more economical and just as good to serve them in another fashion. I mean, we looked at that, as a matter of fact. Your station isn't necessarily the answer. As far as those 20, again, I'll be glad to get them for you and tell you the status of the service they have and what our plans are. We frankly like to move ahead.
For the information of the committee, there has been pending before the Federal Communications Commission a dispute between the state of Alaska and RCA Alaska Communications over who ought to own the earth stations which were purchased by the state in 1975. While that dispute was pending, the FCC ordered the state of Alaska and RCA to enter into an agreement for installing and operating the earth stations, basically to get the service provided now and settle the argument later. That original agreement was with regard to 100 locations. There are a total of 120 earth stations that were purchased by the state, and the dispute, and apparently it was RCA's position that the trustee situation did not cover the last 20. As a result, there are 20 smaller stations sitting in a warehouse in the greater San Francisco Bay Area in California that are owned by the state of Alaska, and at least in my opinion should have been installed in those communities 18 to 24 months ago.
And incidentally, again, we'd like to buy those 20 and we'd like to install them, but we'd like to do it as a normal business. You know, this trusteeship has been a couple of years. It seems time to resolve it.
Are you losing money as a result of the trusteeship? Is there any difference in your revenues or anything that can't be adjusted with regard to any one of the earth stations which is subject to the trusteeship?
I think if you gave me $100 of your money today to invest, and I told you I was going to invest in a joint venture where we assume all the risk, I think you as a stockholder and a shareholder in this company would be concerned if I proceeded along without saying, well, somewhere along the line we have to decide where you stand on your investment.
But you are drawing the conclusion that you're in a proceed at your absolutely your own risk situation. And at least that's not my understanding of the arrangement with regard to the smaller stations. Mr. Osterbeck, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, when this deal went through here a couple of years ago, they said all the communities that had a telephone in would be on the second go-around. Well, Sanford, Wakefield's put in a telephone system in there, so we didn't get an earth station. Last year they told us we would get our earth station right after Dellingham. I don't know if Dellingham got theirs or not. If you look at King Cove and the other places, what didn't have a telephone, they got TV, and all we got is a makeshift telephone up there now that only work half of the time. If we have no TV, they have a TV in the school, what was purchased by the school, and that comes in on film, which is shipped in by mail. But we don't pick up any live TV, and I would like to know what is the reason for that, why one community get it and the other one don't. They said if Sanford wanted, they have to pay RCA $1,500 a month.
I would, you know, and I'll have to speak in generalities rather than specifically on Sandpoint. As far as any service that anybody wants in the state of Alaska, we're more than willing to provide that. Of course, that has to be paid for in some fashion. If, let's say on the state demonstration, if they chose to take it into X number of locations and excluded a certain town, that really was not our decision. We'd be glad to provide service wherever and anybody wants it, if, again, somebody realizes it has to be paid for. I can't specifically say why Sandpoint was excluded from the, if it was excluded from the trial.
I don't know if it's excluded or not, but it isn't there.
Well, but you see, it's not up to us to say what we, you know, we don't go out and say, we'll put TV in here, we RCAA will decide it goes here and we'll put it in there. We take an order from somebody that says they want service, we then provide the service and charge a rate for that service. Now, we'd be very happy to have more TV.
Still didn't answer my question. Why do some get it and some don't?
Well, because the customer has decided they want it in one place and not another, evidently. The customer being the state, yes.
Thank you.
We've been joined by Representative Brian Rogers, who's also sitting at the table. He's a member of the House Finance Committee. I'm sure there will be other questions which may be more in your bailiwick than in any of the other persons here. And I think that we'll probably be wanting to follow up to the matters that you testified about, both with regard to the operations of RCA itself and the issue of the purchase. But for the present, before we go on to some of the other witnesses who I know are here, from whom we wish to hear, is there anyone here who may have come in from out of town who feels that they would only be able to testify today, this morning, and they wouldn't be available this afternoon? I don't know if that's the case. Who's there? Mr. Randall?
No, I can't answer one question for you.
Yes, go ahead.
Just in general, we're sitting here going to discuss the potential sale of RCA Alaska to Pacific Power and Light. Can you briefly give us your version of why this is desirable and
what the arrangements are going to be? Well, again, as I tried to touch on the kickoff, from my point of view, first place, I think we have a very good company, Alascom. The employees that are here, 1,300, 1,400, I think are doing a good job. I'm a little bit like Alvin. I'd like to see better service in the bush, and we're going to have to address that. We're going to address that tomorrow in the governor's task force on communications. I do think, though, that the service that Alascom is providing today in the urban areas, at any rate, is comparable to anything all over 48. The 30 million calls, 33 million calls that will go through well. So I guess I'll start with, I think we have a good company here. And I think in the 7, 8 years it's been here, it's done some marvelous things, and I can say that because I wasn't here during all that period. Now, what can you do to make that better? Well, it seems to me if you identify with a parent company that's in your location, Portland again, that's part of the Northwest, that's part of the growing Northwest. When I talk to my boss in Portland about a problem we're having in Alaska, he understands it much quicker than somebody in New York. I think secondly, the fact that they are in the utility business, when I go to them and say, look, this is a long-term investment, we're going to have to do it this way, they understand because they're operating in the same environment. I still think the biggest thing, and I've got to admit I'm a little naive, I compare it to where I came from 3 years ago in Minnesota when we had a new business that would want to come in, spend $300 million in the state, provide jobs, want to come in, nobody's forcing them, well, the red carpet would be out. I'm so pleased that we've got a company that wants to come into Alaska and wants to be part of it, and really given the state a vote of confidence as far as its future. And I sound like I'm getting carried away, but I think this is extremely important. Some of our employees, have wondered in the past, and now we have a company that wants to be here, and I think that's a definite plus and a definite asset for me.
How did the sale arrangement develop?
It all started, and Fred mentioned, the chairman mentioned a little bit ago, fourth or fifth hand. I'll have to give it to you secondhand because they did approach the parent. A large company approached RCA and asked them, would they be interested in selling this property? And RCA, being prudent business people, said, well, what will you give me? And they sat down and talked to this particular company, and there was an interest. And then they felt obligated to their share owners to solicit other bids. And so I went to four or five different companies. We had an agent that went to others. We asked if they were interested. We had some turn downs by some. We had two or three companies that appeared interested. Some hedged a little bit. Finally, Pacific Power got in the act. Came up here, had study groups up here two or three times, made quite an effort to get to know the company, decided to buy it, and so they moved in and bought it. That went on over a period of about 6 months, I would guess. It was common knowledge that the property was for sale for probably over a period of about 6 months.
Common knowledge within the hierarchy of the industry, I would hasten to say.
Well, I think if you'd go back and look in the media, what was carried in the newspapers here in Alaska and on the news, you give or take 30 days, but it was certainly no secret that there were a lot of people up here looking at this company, and that we were.
The original, I plug in some information if this is correct, was the original company that the large company you referred to, is that Continental Telephone?
It's my understanding that it was Continental. I hesitate to get into naming names right now because I'm giving it to you secondhand, and I don't know whether they'd like to.
It's also my understanding that Continental Telephone had a meeting with the set for the with the officers of the RCA Corporation, 20 Broad Street, New York, for 10 a.m. on a certain Monday morning, which was about 5 days after the date that the purchase by PP&L was announced in Portland and in Anchorage. So I don't know
that sure may have been.
I don't know what levels of communication are going on here. So some of this was obviously well known, and some of it obviously was not. Mr. Randolph,
pretty well covered in the paper, though.
I think this might seem like a simple question, but
what
are you doing here?
What am I doing here this morning?
Right.
I was invited down by this committee and asked if I wished to testify. I frankly have heard other conversations down here, and I wanted to testify to go on record that to hopefully convince some people that this is a good move for Alaska. And it is a good move for Alaska. It's a thing that ought to be done, and I hope that this group and the Senate and everybody else that gets behind it and helps us move it forward. Now, it will be heard, as the chairman said, by the PUC, and there will be ample consideration up there of people under oath and up for cross-examination, and that's where it ought to be. So I'm here to tell you that I think it's a good thing.
You say you want to spend time what specifically you want?
Well, one, I certainly hope you don't come out against it for some reason or other. And secondly, I would see nothing wrong with some form of resolution from the House and the Senate saying that we would at least like to see the matter handled expeditiously. As long as this situation drifts where you have a company that's currently in the position that we're in, it's a little difficult. A lot of our people are uncertain of what's going to happen, and we'd like to get the thing resolved earlier and get on with our business. I really wonder, with our visitor back here, it's his second or third time to Alaska, I just wonder if he feels that we, you know, that we kind of like to have him up here. I don't see anything wrong with that. Might sound a little naive, but I think all the business we can attract to Alaska of this nature, we should.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
As I indicated before, Mr. Agee will be probably getting back to ask you some of these questions. And I would also like to ask the committee to freely interrupt any question I'm asking or any exchange I have with a witness. I've been doing this particular function in the legislature for 4 or 5 years, and I have a technical background which in two areas, which relates to two different sides of the coin, and I don't want to be and too often I've gotten into a situation with Mr. Agee and others where we're exchanging jargon, and 2 weeks later I find out that there was one catchphrase that wasn't familiar in lay conversation, and then the whole point was lost except between us, and that's not very productive. So kick me under the table or send me a nasty note or something if that starts to happen. Mr. Agee, I'm sure that we'll be asking you to testify again maybe later this morning or this afternoon, but we'll go on to someone else right now. I know that Mr. Gleason has come here from Portland, and we would like to hear from him.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Ms. Gleason? Sir, if you would introduce yourself and tell us where you stand.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, I'm Al Gleason, Portland, Oregon. I'm the vice president of the Pacific Power and Light Company and also president of Telephone Utilities, the holding company, which is a subsidiary of Pacific.
Okay, and go ahead, sir. And is your name spelled E-A or E-E?
E-A.
G-L-E-A-S-O-N?
Much like Jackie Gleason.
Ah, yes. Simon Smokey and the Bandit on HBO last
night. No relation.
Go ahead, sir, if you will.
Ben has talked about a number of things that I was going to touch on. I think probably the best thing to do first would be to talk a little bit about Pacific Power and Light, perhaps through some of that, see a little bit of where we're coming from, why the interest, perhaps some of our views. Pacific Power is an electric utility that serves approximately 600,000 electric customers. It's a merger of several smaller utilities, serves most of Wyoming, most of Oregon, parts of western Montana, northern Idaho, parts of central Washington, a little bit of northern California. The service territory covers roughly about 1,000 miles east to west, north to south. They are operating in smaller communities. Portland is the only town of any size where they have any operations, and there they serve roughly 30-40% of the town. Another company serves the balance. Pacific originally went into Wyoming in 1954, ended up acquiring some coal properties to fuel their steam electric plants in that state. As a result of those acquisitions, currently is also in the coal business. They rank in the top 10 in producers and sellers of coal. Part of that coal goes as far east as Detroit, Michigan, and Chicago, Illinois. Pacific also in 1954 acquired a company that had some smaller telephone properties. Nothing was done to expand those properties until 1973, when Telephone Utilities Incorporated, a small holding company headquartered in the state of Washington, was acquired. At that point, Pacific, through Telephone Utilities, then served about 100,000 telephones. Since 1974, through additional acquisitions of smaller exchange companies, and through internal growth, that telephone property has grown to 170,000 telephones, or a number approaching that served within the state of Alaska through the local exchange companies. In looking at size, TU ranks 10th in telephone revenues and independence in the United States. Alaskom ranks 7th, give you some measure of revenue size. We operate in about 27 different locations throughout just about the same territory that Pacific Power serves. Telephone Utilities does not serve property in the state of Wyoming, but does serve in Nevada. Sycar does not serve in Nevada, does in Wyoming. We have 99 local community dial offices. Within our service territory, we operate a very extensive toll network. Roughly 80 to 90% of the toll facilities within our company are owned and operated by Telephone Utilities to the point of interconnection with Bell. That may be a carrier system or a microwave system at the boundary. We operate switching equipment identical to that which serves Juneau and other parts of Alaska for toll purposes. Our operator positions, our inter toll switch is a Northern Telecom SP1 Montana, for example, which is identical to that used by Alaska. We are not providing any service by satellite. It's got one distinct difference. In terms of volumes of toll handled, we generate toll calls originate within our property. Toll calls equal to the number that Ben gave, about 33 million calls, which would be equal to that which Alaskan both originates and terminates. In addition, we have an unknown number of terminated toll calls. We have to do the Bell system to develop the information, but it would be a significant number of calls well into the millions in addition to the original 33 million. So we're not new to the phone business. We are not new to the toll business, although we are not a long lines carrier. We deal with several different Bell companies and Bell long lines for those functions. I think that's a little bit of background, and feel free to interrupt me if I get to a point where there's information needed. RCA Alaska, we learned about this possibility of property being for sale about the 1st of October, perhaps 3 to 4 months after it had been shown to some of the other major companies, and while a couple of other companies were still evaluating it. The week before Thanksgiving, we had completed several trips here and a number of studies which determined that several things. One, that had been indicated Alaska is a developing state. We saw some similarity to that development of Wyoming. In 1954, Wyoming was really quite an undeveloped state. It's now one of the energy capitals of the nation. Pacific is presently the largest single investor, private industry investor in the state of Wyoming, between its electric properties and commercial coal mines. We recognize the value of being a part of the developing state and playing a role in that. We saw that Alaskan had made amazing strides in taking an almost non-existent government communication system into really the most one of the most modern systems in the world. There's a greater amount of satellite communication occurring in Alaska now than the balance of the world combined as far as the numbers of location. The job is not done, and I don't think we'd be interested in it if it were done. But we see it as an investment opportunity and a critical utility service in a growing developing state with additional investment opportunity. That evaluation was completed, as I say, the week before Thanksgiving. The following week, we arranged tentatively for the financing and sit down with RCA and negotiated on the transaction. I guess it's no secret, and I'll tell you what our strategy was. We knew that other companies were interested and were looking, but that none of them had shown up with a firm offer yet. Our arrangement with RCA was very simple. We're not interested in a bidding war. We want to establish the value. If you're serious and want a sale, and so far no one's made an offer, sit down with us and negotiate. If we strike a bargain, then you sign it that day or we withdraw the offer. This obviously put some decision-making heat on the seller. It avoided a bidding war. They either had fish or cut bait. So the transaction occurred very quickly as a result of that. we negotiated, we came to a price which was acceptable to buyer and seller, and they either had accepted that or rejected outright. If they rejected it, and no one else came in with a firm offer or an offer that high, then they were exposed to their stockholders. So it was that kind of negotiation that may be of interest based on the questions I heard you ask earlier. The deal was tentatively signed then the week after Thanksgiving. Since that time, a number of things have happened. We've firmed up the financing. The arrangements have been made with a consortium of banks for a bridge loan for the $200 million approximate purchase price. Ben talked about a $300 million deal. Is that, and we have the debt that's assumed through the purchase debt on Alaska's book. Alaska Pacific Bank and the NBA are both participants in that bridge financing transaction.
I'm sorry, you said that? Alaska Pacific?
Alaska Pacific and NBA are both participants in the bridge financing, along with 9 or 10 other banks around the United States. Fairly heavy concentration on the West Coast. It's headed by the Morgan Bank, who have historically been Pacific's banker long before there were any financial centers on the West Coast.
Morgan Guaranty Trust Company
of New York. But both Seattle banks are in it, several banks in California and Chicago, etc.
You made some reference to Alaska's debt, and I probably am asking questions that you've already answered in many settings, but what is the debt of RC Alaskom that you would be assuming, and what requirements or changes are the creditors stating to you?
Could I answer that question as a part of
the
description of the transaction?
If that's in your in your presentation, yes. Whenever it comes up,
like
yes.
That.
Yes, if you would.
Okay, let's talk then about the deal itself. We have since the original negotiation, the boards of directors of both companies have formally approved a definitive purchase and sale agreement. That agreement provides that we will pay $200 million for the stock of RCA Alaskom, plus any increases in net worth from 1/1/79 to date of closing. That $200 million is roughly $35 million more than the book price of RCA. I've been asked the question, how will that $35 million be recorded? It's recorded only on the books of Pacific Power or its holding company that we established as the financing vehicle to make the purchase. It does not affect the books of Alaskom. Alaskom's books remain unchanged. Any rate-making activity that would be affected in the state of Alaska would be based on the original investment of Alaskom in utility property in the state. It's really no different than if a member of the committee went into the marketplace and bought General Motors stock or the stock of any publicly traded company at an amount greater than book value. It would not affect General Motors books at all. That acquisition cost would be on the individual investment records of the person who made the purchase.
Well, doesn't that then mean that the additional $35 million would affect the judgment of, say, a stockholder of Pacific Power and Light when they were looking at the purchase of RC Alaskom in retrospect for determining what return on its investment? Not in a regulated sphere necessarily, but in the usual private transaction sphere, what return on its investment was Pacific Power and Light getting 1, 2, 3, or 4 years from now? That certainly is true.
That's very true, because what you indicate comes into play. In effect, the stockholder, through the board of directors of Pacific, has said, we will pay $200 million for Alaskom, because and recognize that there's some goodwill or additional cost above book, because it allows us to become an investor in that state and will give us a future opportunity to make investments. So they are taking a lesser return on their initial investment with the hope that the future will give them a full return on new dollars invested in the state.
Well, I suppose the direction I was going with the question is that it's still possible, isn't it, that the additional $35 million could have a long-range effect on the ratepayer in Alaska under this scenario I'll describe. That is, it had Pacific Power and Light paid RCA $210 million rather than $235 million, for instance, then there would be less pressure by a stockholder or a group of stockholders of Pacific Power and Light on its management to make a certain dollar return, because that dollar return would be less of a rate of return on their investment in the private sector, not in the regulated sector, with regard to management decisions 2, 3, 4 years from now.
Representative Brown, I think not, because rate setting in Alaska is done on the investment within the state of Alaska. So the regulatory body within this state will look at the equity investment within Alaska.
I wasn't talking about the regulatory body. I was talking about management behavior within Alaska, which then determines what rate cases are filed, which is then determined by the management of PP&L, which is determined by the attitude of the shareholders, seeing that $35 million more was invested in 1979, say, rather than perhaps only $10 million more, and then looking to their management saying, where is the return on this investment we made last year, five years ago?
I understand
that it is not within the regulatory sphere, but it could be indirectly within the regulatory sphere, and that it could involve the management decisions being made by Alaska's management at that time.
Well, I would think that if Alaska's management were prudent management, they would attempt at all times to earn whatever the state allows as a fair investment, a fair return on investment on this property, without any regard to the parent company's possession. So, and that's the thrust I was attempting to address. So,
no doubt this is not the first time you've been submitted to this line of questioning.
No doubt
it will not be the last.
It is not. That's why I felt it'd be important to pursue it. A rate application in the state of Alaska will affect only investment directly placed within the state. In other words, the books of Alaska. The regulatory body here will look about the rest of the investment world and find what returns are allowed for like property elsewhere in the investment world, and theoretically will allow a similar return on the original investment of Alaska to provide public service. So it seems very unlikely that there would ever be any extra weight factor considered by the Alaska PUC because of a stock transaction outside of the state. I'm sure that Continental or Gentel within the state of Alaska is regulated strictly on the investment in Alaska without regard to the external investment.
Well, what's before a regulatory authority is usually based upon what's been brought to the authority in the nature of an application by the regulated utility, is that right?
A regulatory body does not initiate an investigation unless the rate of return is too high. Mm-hmm. So a management seeing a low rate of return or a lowering of the rate of return within the state in which they operate will take action to file an application. And
so
that application then will be considered by the regulatory body.
So that is a management decision.
That is a management decision.
And therefore, that's the sort of management decision that is subject to the pressure from the stockholders of the sort I was describing.
But I think you're talking only about timeliness. For any investor, anyone who would own Alaska would want to see its local management keep its earnings level at a reasonable return at all times, regardless of what other investments they make. But I guess that's where we differ.
Well, I don't differ with that. If I were buying RCA Alaska, I'd be doing the same thing.
Okay, let me go on then and address.
Mrs. Munson had a question.
Excuse me.
Yes. Mr. Gleason, it's my understanding that the management will continue as is. I'm sure that you investigated the management as well as all other facets before this sort of investment was even discussed. You used the terminology prudent management, and since this management will continue, and knowing that there have been problems over the years, I don't know if these were RCA's problems or the state's problems, the regulatory agencies, or a combination of all of them. I would assume that all of these things taken under consideration, and with this one particular problem still pending, by a change in owners, can you assure me, or not assure me, but give me some indication of how you would see the any differences.
Okay, well, let me then discuss management. Obviously, we would not have been interested in the company without its present management. As a student of RCA Alascom, which I've had to become in the last months, it's apparent that RCA originally tried to develop and operate this property not with telephone utility people, but with people from other fields. In the past several years, they've corrected a number of those early decisions. They have acquired a number of other people from outside the area who had significant telephone experience. I'm not just talking about Mr. A.G., but in the fields of finance, accounting, other levels within the company. Some of the people who originally came with the property have gained experience and knowledge and were extremely competent people in their own fields originally and have become telephone people. So we see the management group as being relatively strong today. I'm not able to evaluate fully the past, but I suspect there have been problems in the past from what I've learned through conversations with others. Our intent is to do everything possible to hold that management group in place. We want to make the workplace attractive to them, the job challenging, and support them with needed investment funds so that they can do the job that's their responsibility. We would hope to change some of the emphasis, I think, because the present owner is an industrial company with a need to respond quickly to changes and keep levels of earnings always at a peak position, but they have a good deal of pressure on them for short-term response. The utility can't afford that. We were in business yesterday. If we do our job, we have the privilege of being back in business tomorrow. We have to take a little bit longer perspective. One of my early meetings after the deal was announced with the Alascom management people led me to conclude that what I just said would be true. Because I said, gee, what about these problems, the Bush ownership, the intrastate rate case? What are you going to do about these? I said, well, these are today's problems. We'll face them as best we can today. Next year or the year after, we're going to have other problems. Those are the ones we really ought to be worrying about. Today, this is our work, but we need to take a longer-range perspective. I think what I'm talking about is a little bit of a philosophy change that I think, as I've talked to these men and women, they're very interested in. I think they feel, I'm putting words in their mouth, and that's unfair because they still work for their present employer, that I think they feel that perhaps the emphasis on the utility planning and utility motive operation will be supportive to them. And that's my challenge, is to be sure they feel that way and deliver on that promise. Hopefully that will answer the question.
Thank you.
We don't want to manage the property actively from Portland, Oregon. We want to play the role of a knowledgeable, supportive investor and provide whatever tools are necessary to the Alascom management to do their job here. Telephone utilities is run in that same fashion. I have a board of directors which has only one other member of civics management on it. I report really to that board more than I do to the parent company. I have a good deal of freedom to run the business for the sake of the telephone service that we provide.
Could you go into that some more? Are you saying that on your board of directors of telephone utilities, there is only one person who is from the management of the stockholder who wholly owns the company?
It's not a wholly owned company, Representative Brown. It's an 80% owned subsidiary. There are 3,000 other minority shareholders.
So 80% of TU is owned by PPL.
That's correct. And on the board...
How many members are on that board?
Presently, it's 8. It's normally a 9-man board. I have one vacancy on it. Mr. John Geiger, the finance officer at Pacific, and myself are the only representatives of the 80% shareholders. The others are minority shareholders, largely from the service area.
Mr. Geiger, are you on the board yourself?
Yes.
And who is chairman of the board?
There is no named chairman. I or one of the other board members may act depending on the circumstances of the meeting.
Isn't that rather unusual?
It is rather unusual, but if you look at the parent company, you'll see much the same. Civic is a large company, about a $2.5 billion asset company. It has some 90,000 shareholders, about 60% of whom are west of the Mississippi. No one owns anywhere near 5% of the stock. It's very broadly held. That board is composed almost entirely of small shareholders who reside in its service territory.
You're talking about the board of this, for the parent.
I'm talking about the board of Pacific. Yeah. Pacific. The TU board is much the same. Our plans for Alaska would not be a lot different. I may well be the only board member from Portland on that Alaska board. The remaining board members are probably 7 or 8. We include maybe 1 or 2 representatives of management in Anchorage. The balance of the board seats would be filled by residents of the state to give a voice that reflects the interest of the state. Now, I recognize the state has many voices. A state of this size and of this demographic makeup, there's no one person or no 6 or 7 people who are going to reflect all interests. But hopefully we can get people in those 6 or 7 seats who will at least be sensitive to these issues around the state, be knowledgeable of them, and convey that to the management of Alaska.
You referred earlier, if I'm interposing into her line of questioning, if I might, Madam Vice Chairman, you referred earlier to a holding company. Is PP&L holding or creating a new company which then will, separate from telephone utilities, that will actually own RC Alaska?
Yes. A company called PACCOM will be the financing vehicle and the holding company for the Alaskan stuff.
Yes.
It will be a sister company to telephone utilities.
Mrs. Williams had some problem figuring out what PACCOM was when she was preparing the transcript here, I noticed. And, well, what relationship, direct relationship, if any, then will... will Alaskom have with telephone utilities, or will it?
Okay, let me clarify that point. As a vice president of Pacific, I will have responsibility for both of the telephone subsidiaries. We will be able to draw expertise from either of those properties to assist the other one. We'll provide perhaps an advancement or an opportunity for promotion from one company to the other, which should make it more attractive to retain and attract competent telephone people. They will be maintained as separate entities. They will be managed up to the point of reporting to me as separate organizations. Hopefully it'll be a case where we can use the strengths of both to support one another. But they will be sister companies or brother companies or whatever.
So you are a vice president of Pacific Power and Light, and under the proposal, you would also be on the board of both Telephone Utilities and PACCOM, and you are also an officer of Telephone Utilities this time?
That's correct.
And what is your position?
I'm president of
the Telephone Utilities. So you're president. What happens if you get run over by a garbage truck?
I suspect Mr. Agee would probably become the responsible party for both companies. As far as operations in TU, in the past 5 years, we've built a significant management team, and I'm sure TU wouldn't miss me.
The first person who's ever responded quickly to my hypothetical, which is rather well known for me, is the what happens if you get run over by a garbage truck? Most people have to shake their head and think about it.
Representative Brown, I use the term myself, except I continually remind my management people that they should be willing to accept certain responsibilities because I might be run over by a beer truck.
Oh, beer truck. I think I like that a little bit.
I live with your line of thought.
Mrs. Munson, I interrupted your line of question.
Oh, no, I received an answer that I thought was fine.
So we go ahead with your presentation. We'll probably jump in again.
Okay. I think I've pretty well covered the... Okay, on to the debt of Alaska. You asked some questions about the $90 million assumption. Alascom, within the last year and a half, had placed a $90 million debt issue with six insurance companies. That was done at a time when interest rates were very favorably, and because RCA agreed to remain as the parent of Alascom, a rate was obtained that was 8.5%, extremely attractive. That agreement provided that should RCA sell Alascom, the holders of the debt would have the right to recall it at 100% plus a penalty equal to 1 year's interest, or in effect 108.5% to the principal. Obviously that would have been disastrous to the transaction, disastrous to the ratepayers in Alaska. So we had to set about some way to resolve that problem, put this transaction together. We were able to go to the insurance companies during the month of December and negotiate an arrangement where they would agree to accept the substitution of Pacific as a creditworthy person who's not a guarantor of the debt. The Alascom is the only person who actually is obligated for the debt. The insurance companies agreed to accept Pacific as the owner of the stock of Alascom in substitution for RCA, and agreed to accept as compensation for that 0.25%. So in effect, that note will increase to 8.75%. The cost to the ratepayer of that is de minimis. Had the RCA simply sold the stock and the insurance companies exercised their right under the agreement with Alascom, the new cost of money would have been roughly 10%, nothing less than 9.75%.
Well, then the debt was previously guaranteed by RCA?
No, sir.
Was
it? It was not guaranteed by RCA. RCA simply pledged to continue to remain the owner of the stock of Alaska.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So what you have is a lender saying, okay, I know you can't guarantee the debt or won't, but it would give me great comfort to know that Alascom is owned by a substantial corporation.
I think I knew that a long time ago. Is there a similar covenant or commitment on the part of PP&L or Telephone Utilities in their arrangement with the creditor?
As I indicated, simply a substitution of Pacific for RCA in that covenant.
So that in the event that you were to sell it, again the question would arise as to whether they would accelerate the loan.
That's correct.
Go ahead.
The cost of that to the ratepayer is infinitesimal. It's something like 4 mils on any individual long-distance call. So obviously that would trigger no rate case, or would it be seen immediately? Over time, it will get into the rate-making process. You'll never find it, it's that small. We're very pleased to be able to renegotiate that loan on that basis. It could have been a deal.
Considering the current money market, I can see why.
Yeah, it could have been a deal breaker. When we advised the Alaskan Commission of that transaction, they really didn't believe it. They shook their head in disbelief.
By the way, could you send us, this committee, a couple of copies of the all the last 2 years' annual reports to the stockholders of Pacific Power and Light? And you probably don't have, since Telephone Utilities itself, is it considered to be a publicly owned company?
It is a publicly owned company.
Because of the 20%?
It's traded over the counter nationally, okay. And we'll provide reports.
Then if we could have the reports for Telephone Utilities also.
All of those reports were submitted, I think, for 5 years to the regulatory body, and we'll be pleased to make them available.
I don't want to try to destroy as many trees as I know the Alaska Public Utilities Commission will in their consideration of the purchase. I know what kind of volume of material they're going to have in paper over the next few months on this matter. But
if it were stacked between us now, we couldn't see one.
That's right. So just a glimpse, but not a strangle.
Okay, another question that's been asked that I would like to address, and let me know if I'm running short on your time, is the credit of Pacific. Can Pacific really, through a subsidiary PACCOM, make available the necessary funds to provide continuing public service in Alaska? I think the answer to that, barring an economic disaster like the 1930s when the world would turn upside down anyway, is an unqualified yes. We were able to go to a consortium of banks and provide a bridge loan, which will be repaid 50% over a 5-year period, the balance through a debt placement at that time, up to $210 million to buy the property. That's secured simply with the purchase of the stock purchased, and a pledge from Pacific to cause its subsidiary to perform.
Now,
Pacific, excuse me.
Could you go into some more detail about that? What is, in the simple-minded, small-town way, what is, or translated into that kind of jargon, what is the collateral for the loan
from the
group of banks put together by Morgan Guaranty?
The collateral is the stock of Alaska. In addition to that collateral, Pacific has entered into a stock subscription agreement with its subsidiary, where it commits to buy stock in the subsidiary sufficient to provide the cash needs of the subsidiary for that 5-year period.
So that Pacific Power and Light will be buying more stock of Telephone Utilities, which will...
No.
Which subsidiary?
Of PACCOM.
Okay, that, the new subsidiary.
The new subsidiary.
I see.
Again, this is a sister company. It's not a part of TU. The credit of TU is simply not large enough because of its size to stand behind a bigger company, Alascom. So it required a Pacific to do this directly through another subsidiary.
So in the worst of all possible worlds, a consortium of banks could end up owning RC Alascom, I suppose.
Only with the approval of the Alaskan Commission and the FCC, which wouldn't be forthcoming.
So they would really end up being a broker looking for another buyer that was a telephone company at the behest of the regulatory authorities if that disaster were to occur.
That's correct. And they recognize that. Pacific presently has three sources of short-term credit. They have a $75 million loan agreement with a consortium of banks whereby they can borrow and repay from time to time up to $75 million. They have a $75 million Eurodollar agreement with a group of European banks where they can do the same thing. In addition...
Would you say that last thing you just said again?
Okay, Pacific has two lines of temporary credit with banks, a $75 million domestic line and a $75 million Eurodollar line with a group of European banks. That totals $150 million. In addition to that, Civic has the ability to issue about $85 million worth of commercial paper. They use whichever of those lines provides the cheapest interest rate. And that will vary from time to time, depending on both domestic and international money rates. Presently, less than one of those lines is outstanding, about $50 to $60 million, depending on what day is involved. The company has approval from this board and plans to sell $100 million of long-term debt in April of this year, maybe early May, depending on market timing. So at that time, then, the full $235 million credit line will be renewed and available. And this is the manner in which the company historically has funded itself. We would obviously be able to provide the funds required for Alascom's budget. Alascom spends roughly $50 to $60 million a year, which 10 to 15 is required from outside the state. So that money we would be quite willing to provide through the subsidiary.
Your third line of financing request?
Commercial paper, where a company simply sells through investment dealers a pledge to pay in 90 days X number of dollars at X rate. Other companies that are in long-term are not in need of cash, have cash surpluses, will buy that paper, and it's just sort of a company-to-company pledge, avoiding the banking system, much to the consternation of the lenders.
Now, I may think that I know the difference, but could you explain in the way that you would to somebody other than the chairman of this committee, who was an average individual you'd meet on the street in Alaska, for instance, in a little more detail what the likely difference in management attitude would be between a company that was primarily involved as a regulated utility like your company and the RCA Corporation?
Well, I could spend either 15 minutes or half a day or 2 minutes.
You should try maybe 15.
Okay. Chairman Brown, the differences are largely philosophy. Being in a regulated environment with two different, well, actually, Pacific has some small water properties, so they're involved in regulation in a number of different ways. Essentially, we recognize that a monopoly, and for interstate purposes at the moment, Alascom is a monopoly. For interstate purposes, that monopoly no longer exists.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Excuse me.
I don't know if people behind you can hear you.
I do have a low voice, and I recognize it. Alascom does have a monopoly within the state at the moment. As far as interstate services, it is not a monopoly carrier. So long as you are a monopoly, you are going to be regulated within a given range as to what you can earn. If you earn less than that given range, then you do file for an increase. If you start to earn more than that range, the commission will require you to effect a decrease. So with that, with those two things going, one, a closely regulated rate of return, and two, a protection from certain types of competition, regulation then becomes a necessity in order to ensure that the ratepayer is treated fairly. Being in the utility business, you accept this as one of the costs of doing business, or one of the prices you pay for the privilege. You recognize that each of the states you operate in have different economic, political, and social interests. Those are reflected in the laws of that state and in the actions of the administrative body, in this case, the Alaskan Public Utility Commission.
How many different regulatory bodies does Pacific Power and Light and its various companies deal with in the several states?
Well, let's talk only about the state regulatory body. Pacific operates in 5 states. Telephone Utilities operates in 6 states. So we are dealing day-to-day with state regulatory bodies in each of those states for each of those utilities. In addition, Pacific operates water properties in 3 states, so they are dealing with those same commissions on water nets. So recognizing then the need for regulation in this business, where regulation comes from, and that's the social and political factors that I described, you simply say, okay, that's a part of doing business. I will adapt to them and meet the needs that are expressed through those regulators. Whatever rules they establish, we will play by them, and we'll provide our public service job and continue to have the privilege of doing so by living in that environment. So really, excuse me.
Whenever I disappear, the vice chairman is right.
Okay, thank you. Chairman, thank you. Okay, recognizing that then, your organization must, to be effective, reflect that policy at all levels. We are a utility, we are here to provide service, and we're here to provide those services that the state, through its agency or through its individual customers, requests. And I think Ben addressed that briefly earlier, that if the state wants certain services in certain locations and funds in order for it, that the utility is beholden to immediately undertake on a reasonable financial basis its obligation. So that sort of attitude, I think, perhaps is more readily adaptable to a management that has lived in that environment, rather than a management that's essentially non-regulated, regulated by the free marketplace, where really management calls a lot more of the shots and does a lot more of the planning and decision. Okay, what changes then occur in Alaskan? I really don't think. I think the people who are here now, based on my conversations with them, accept those things that I've said, and they're only too glad to perform in that fashion. So I think a change of philosophy, perhaps a change in emphasis to a little longer-term goal, will make their job easier. We talked about that a little bit earlier.
I'd like to go into that a little bit, and I'll just be as candid as possible. Except for reading part of about the newspapers, first time I had some direct dealings with RC Alaska Communications was right after I was first elected to the legislature in 1974. And we had a meeting that was supposed to be a briefing for new legislators by the then president, Stephen Heller, who had not come from the regulated utility area but was part of the old RCA family. And others who were then in the company. And when I arrived here as a freshman legislator, I found that some people, principally in the Senate, had been very much involved and concerned with telecommunications matters back to periods predating the purchase and long before that. And they were Senator Holman and Senator Fertula particularly, also a former governor who's now on the Alaska Transportation Commission, involved. And Governor Bill Egan and Governor Hammond, who was then very new. People found out that I had some kind of a background because of my, the coincidence of my two professions for which I was trained, and therefore I ended up filling a void, I guess. And then summer of 1975, we stole Professor Stanley and Professor Merritt from Governor's office. Went on from there, and over the period that I saw, the thing that always bothered me was that, this is not saying anything bad about Ben or Chuck or any predecessors, it seemed as though something would seem to be true until, and then signals would change very quickly. RC Alaska attitudes would change, and it always seemed to be, sometimes you could even time it to the Eastern time zone time of closing business, that we found that very frustrating. It was more true, much more true, when Mr. Heller was president of the company, possibly because of his attitudes, because he'd grown up in the RCA Corporation anyway. But all the time I was talking to Mr. Heller, at least, I always felt that I really should have been talking to Mr. Hawkins in New York, and sometimes, at least, with regard to the consideration of some of the recent rate cases, I wondered if, or just to try to explain management behavior of RCA Lascom, I wondered if there were nasty phone calls, or not nasty, but rather abrupt business-like phone calls being made in the morning from 20 Broad Street in New York. So I suppose I'm not asking a question, I'm making a statement. I understand that, according to a note I have from someone else here, I'm authorized to say it, that the bill that was referred to earlier this morning is going to be introduced today by Representative Anderson, and he's going to have 12 co-sponsors that would be involved in setting up a public entity to make an offer to the RCA Corporation to purchase a Lascom. But whether or not that were true, or assuming that that were not an issue, which it may become, at least it's the position of this chairman that I'm very concerned that if someone buys RCA and they are in the private sector, that it be a public utility for many of the reasons you've regulated utility, somebody that knows that line of business. Because I don't see much comparison at all between a long line telephone company, Hertz Rent-A-Car, RCA Victor, Records Division, or how many other subsidiaries they have. They're almost all in competitive markets, require a certain management philosophy for all of those markets, which is a very different business tradition, if you like, from the unique problems that you've been outlining that regulated utilities are. So I just thought I'd jump in with that.
Go ahead. I appreciate your statement of support.
if it was one, Mrs. Munson?
Yes, and I know that you're going to give us an opinion from absolutely a business standpoint. as the chairman has referred to, the bill that will come before us, where we might consider a state-owned utility. Other than the fact that there's a large purchase price involved in buying it, and also this $900 million debt. I don't know exactly how that would work either for the state.
$90 million.
I just raised it a little bit.
We do that now.
We do that now and then. What is your feeling on state-owned? And I know that I recognize what you're going to give me, but I also recognize that you're in business, and very good business practice, or you wouldn't be around.
Well, again, you have to recognize that I come from...
May I throw in an additional thing that you could answer all at once, and that is, as part of your answer, have you dealt with any state-owned or government-owned utilities in the course of your business, in addition to whatever else you were going to say in answer to the first question? And if so, what was your experience?
There are some government-owned utilities. You probably have more telephone utilities owned by government in Alaska than you do anywhere else in the United States. Those are in a defined area where hopefully you can have some singleness of purpose, and the political persuasion of the local populace comes into play. Obviously, I am a champion of private enterprise and feel that the profit discipline is necessary to ensure a long-term efficient operation. Nowhere except in the United States is the telephone service owned by a conglomeration of private businesses that I'm aware. almost all foreign countries are government owned, and I think with the possible exception of Japan, which is a extremely highly disciplined society, and planning in almost all facets is top down. Nowhere else that I'm aware of is a really superbly run telephone system that's available universally to all members of the public. When I say all, I'm talking